This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
On my guest list today, I have one of my good friends, Thomas Mills, in the back. I'm excited to have Thomas here on the podcast. It's been a bit for him and I. Thomas, fortunately, he's coming out to New York State. He's going to be visiting me in a few weeks. He's going to be at the Habitat Day. That's kind of a surprise for those that don't know. We have, I think I limited it to about 15 people. There's going to be up to 15 people at the Habitat Day. Multiple presenters. Thomas will be one. I will be one. Timmy Russell. Look, we're going to have another gentleman, Dave Allen, at lunch. We have an equipment presentation. So it's going to be a pretty all-out day. You get to spend time with me and learn from me, and I get to learn from you, and I think that's exciting. So I'm happy to have Mills in the back. So Mills, what have you been up to, man? What's going on in your world?
Well, John, thanks for having me back on. My world, we were just talking prior to punching the record button about the actual land management work, you know, in the field type physical work. And that's why I said we need to hit record, because I could go down a rabbit hole or go off on a tangent, however you want to look at it, because right now I'm in it, right? I'm in it. And you know, anyone listening to this podcast knows that, you know, throughout the dormant season, and the way I kind of explain things to my clients, you know, we're trying to shift this mentality to think about the aspects of the land. How do we manage the land? We're working with the land, you know, and you talked about it just recently, biomimicry, and you're talking about things like we're working with biology, we're working with nature as much as possible. And as a land manager, you know, during the dormant season, it just feels like a Sunday morning, you know, where you're kind of relaxed and you're thinking about, you know, maybe you're thinking a little bit about the work week and thinking about this, so maybe I'll run some errands, maybe I'll just do some stuff in the yard, whatever. You know, it's the dormant season. And then all of a sudden you hit the growing season. You're like, oh, I've only got so many days till maturity. I've only got so many days to do this. We're going to be here. Pretty soon the hunting season's going to be here. I got to prep for that. I got to get this installed. I got to do that. I got to do that. I got to do that. And that's just if you're a landowner talking about your own property. And I'm essentially farming like 30 properties as far north as Duluth, Minnesota, and as far south as southern Iowa, northern Missouri. And it's just a battle right now. If anyone that lives in the Midwest, and you guys are getting some of this too, it's just like, it's been raining nonstop here. You know, the timeline gets thrown off so quickly. And when you have one job stacked, or, you know, waiting in line, stacked behind another job, and then the rain hits and gets things thrown off. And my challenge, where I was going when I said we need to hit record, I work in the Driftless region, right? You've been here. I mean, in your area's got topography. But it was interesting. I just got off the phone with a logger that I had out looking at two different client projects yesterday, again, because it's been rainy and wet. So the loggers aren't working either, which is actually a lot easier to get a hold of him, because normally a lot of loggers aren't great at returning calls, but he's out scoping some properties out for me. And we were talking this type of work, this like land related physical labor, equipment labor, stuff like that's getting harder and harder and harder because all of that easy land that's super accessible or nice and flat keeps on getting developed and cleared, farmed, whatever it might be. Properties are getting split up by us. You know, you get a 200 acre farm or 160 acre farm, and the first thing that happens when they want to sell it is they sell the fields to the local cash cropper, and then the woods, you know, if it's anywhere flat at all that can be cleared, maybe it's decent pasture, that gets sold to the Amish, and then they come in and clear all that out. And then there's like this little sliver in the back corner that's too steep to get any piece of equipment in there that some guy from two states away gets lulled into buying, or I should say tricked into buying from some whitetail hunting focused real estate group that tells him it's a turnkey property and he's going to kill all the giant deer in the world because the area does have giant deer and it can produce giant deer. And that property might very well hold that potential, which is the frustrating part. It holds that potential, but accomplishing that goal or getting that property to that level of potential is getting increasingly hard due to accessibility on these properties. And no one has that foresight to think about that. And that's just one limited factor there. You know, I could go on for days about how that same type of transaction is destroying some of these small rural communities because these properties are losing value as a whole and increasing the tax base. It's just, sorry, it's a rainy day. It's a rainy day here.
There's a lot of highlight points in that. The cost of land ownership is going up. The quality of land is getting devalued in these certain practices. There's real estate agencies now that are increasing the value because they're putting a buck on the bag, so to speak, on deer hunting properties without making any changes whatsoever. And we aren't doing a good job of truly assessing quality. And what we forget about is quality from the ground up and looking at the whole aspect of it. You know, access is critical. My property has some access issues, but even in a logging situation, you know, that could be very problematic if you want to harvest timber. There's a million things that come with having multiple access routes in your property, but good access routes. I mean, you could have multiple access, but are they good? And just physically engaging with the property enough, making those hard decisions. Like, I can value almost everything on a property to come up with, okay, this is what it's going to cost to fix. This is what it needs, you know, and buying that property at a bargain price, it ends up not being extremely like relatable because you should have spent a little bit more money buying a better end property, maybe in a different area. The difference, I think a little bit difference, and there's not big, big differences in everything you just discussed on how land's being broken up. But one big difference is the quality of hunting in these areas, particularly in the Northeast, they're very pockety. So you could be in a really poor area and have these same circumstances, but again, they tout them as big buck properties and they might not be. So my only suggestion to anybody beyond the points that you're just trying to make, which I think are all valid, is at least getting some information on the herd. Herd survey information is like really, really critical. I think a first steps principle to looking at quality beyond the particularities around a land when it comes to access and vegetation quality and biodiversity and just value. You know, there's two pieces of this puzzle.
Well, I have to be careful what I say.
This is a free country.
This is like one of those like internal battles I deal with daily and like kind of the dichotomy of my life in general, but I've got a lot of really good friends that are really good people, down to earth, great guys, like, you know, the top 10 guys on my phone that I pick up the phone and call when I need to bury a body, so to speak, not actually, right? But so to speak, like a lot of those guys fit into those categories and they're realtors. And, you know, I guess my best advice to anyone who's looking to buy land, get a third party consultation at some level. And I'm not saying this from a sales pitch from my own perspective, but a realtor is selling you land. That is their job, right? They like to tout themselves as a land professional, which they are, but they're biased. At the end of the day, they are biased, and they're biased towards the sale. They're biased towards the profit that they're going to make, their brokerage is going to make, their client's going to make, so on, right? And I'm not here to undercut their bottom line, but so many times and so much, especially recently, these properties are getting way, way oversold for what they are. And again, the potential is there, but case in point, I'm working on two client properties that are, this is actually like a best case scenario for as bad as this is. Both of these properties have around 30 acres plus of pine tree plantations on them that need to be harvested. It is a biological desert within those. The logger literally is like, yeah, you know what I didn't anticipate, given that it was cloudy and rainy yesterday, is that I would need a flashlight when I walked through that woods at 2 o'clock in the afternoon because it was so dark in there. I was like, yeah, not much going on. But both properties have 30-ish acres of, most of them are white pines that are about 30 years old. So we're talking 10, maybe 15-inch diameter trees in some locations. Some of them are... What's that?
Are they row stacked?
Row stacked. Yep. They're all in rows. Yep. So, you know, I found a guy, you know, locally, there's not a lot of loggers set up with equipment to efficiently handle that type of a project by us because it's mostly hardwood timber, hillsides, you know, it's, you know, hand cutting, skidder dragging, you know, winching up hills, winching down hills, dragging out, right? The trade-off or the challenge is that that type of wood has some value to it. And this type of wood doesn't have a whole lot of value. They can pull X number of bolts out of there, you know, down to a certain diameter size, but the bulk of it is pulpwood. And the closest pulpwood mill to our area is about 75 miles.
Yeah.
So there's out. Like almost, you know, and not even, and I, as soon as I walk on a property like this, I try to get that client thinking about logging purely from a management improvement or a habitat improvement perspective and not an income generator. I tell them best case, yes, I say best case scenario, we break even on this project. Best case scenario.
Yep.
Worst case scenario, and what I discussed with this guy is, can you just give me a daily rate on what it's going to cost you to bring your processing head on your excavator in here and cut and drop trees? Maybe we just push them in piles. Maybe we mulch X percentage of them. Maybe we burn some. Maybe we just let them all break down in a certain area. I don't know. We have a resource. We want to utilize it. I don't want to waste it. You know, and for that reason, it's like when you start looking at these properties, it's like, what is your best option if you're paying for all of these things? But two properties, 30 plus acres, 30 year old pine plantation, both of them have really good, I shouldn't say really good, but moderately good access from the sense of like, I can drive an ATV in from this side and I can hunt this area. But as far as equipment access goes and getting log trucks in and out or close proximity, terrible. Both of them, the best option is to go across the neighbor's field to get those logs out. Well, now your project just got more complex because not only do you have to be on board for this logging plan and find a logger and find a mill and all these things, but now you have to work with the timeline of your neighbor. And if we back all the way up to the fact that some realtor that's not familiar with anyone in the area sold this land to people that aren't from the area and no one really knew what was going on, and now you're going to go to this neighbor that you've never talked to before, or maybe you took advice from other well-known consultants out there and you put up a fence on one or two sides of your property to stop that neighbor from killing your deer, right? Your deer. Then you go to them and you ask if you can cross that field. What do you think they're going to say? No, definitely not. I don't think so. So, in most situations, it wouldn't be a problem. Like I can show you these maps and stuff. And it's like, well, you know, this is a 200-yard shot across that field, perfect area to stage logs, no problem. But if we can't do that, then we have to get a dozer in here for a day, build a whole new road system over here, add a bigger culvert, truck in 3 dump truck loads of breaker runs so that trucks can get on the county road without destroying the county road because we can't be liable for the county road. And you're talking about all this to extract pulpwood that has to go 75 miles one way to the mill. And it's going to be your total in-pocket income from something like that's going to be about 50 cents to a dollar per ton of material that makes it that mill. So again, you know, it's like, where do you go? And what I would tell anyone, you know, again, get a third party consultation. I look at a lot of properties for guys and just straight up, I'm like, if you're going to buy that property, then that realtor that's making $300K off of doing almost nothing on this sale needs to have in writing an easement set up for logging or resource extraction from this property. And there has to be an agreement, not just across this field here from time to time, but like there has to be an agreement that you can move things off that property, because you might even have a property, you know, this is even probably worst case scenario, is that you have a property with a lot of timber value on it, and then you don't have a neighbor that wants you to access it, right? So,
or they want an exorbitant amount to kind of support that access.
Correct.
And I've seen that more times than not.
So yeah, no, 100%, 100%. So the silver lining of the situation I'm in is these two properties are actually relatively close to each other. They're only about 7 miles apart. So for, you know, from the logger's perspective, like, yeah, if you're going to move all your equipment to this area, because he's coming from 45 miles away as well. Again, this area is not set up for pulp harvest, so I got to bring him in, but it's a lot better situation for him as a whole. But from these individual clients and just the logistics behind it, it's a challenge.
All right. So, well, let's solutions, because it's a solution based podcast. So let's get to application. What do you think you should do in that row situation? What there's options to cut and leave, cut and take, cut and mulch, burn. What are you going to do? Are you going to do a smorgasbord? What do you think?
Yep. So, you know, we've probably talked about this before. I find myself talking about this frequently on properties. There's two types of habitat improvement, initial implementation, I should say. There's two types of implementation. If you really just like sift it down to like simplification, you have habitat improvement via addition and you have habitat improvement via deletion, right? So you're you're taking out things and letting things grow back in. Maybe there's a combination of both, right? You know, it's a whole formula there, right? And there is certainly a combination of both, but you know, like a field conversion would be addition. You're planting rows of trees and shrubs or pockets or plots and, you know, different native plantings, whatever it might be. And then in this situation with these pine plantings that are all in rows, it is purely deletion. And then, you know, obviously we are going to choose and govern what regenerates in those areas or what we plant, whatever it might be. But there are limitations. You know, if you look at it from a drone or from a satellite image, it's like, oh, okay, I've got these rows of trees. Well, what are we working with? We're dealing with white pine. So white pine's pretty good as far as like how it holds its needles up the side of the tree and whatnot. It will thin out a little bit towards the bottom. But once they reach a certain age and they crowd each other, then they lose all the needles that aren't getting sunlight. So when you go into these areas, and again, from above, it looks like, you know, you're looking at a forest full of 70-foot tall Christmas trees, 50 to 70-foot tall Christmas trees. But realistically, only the pines, only the trees on the outer rows have needles on the outside to the extent where they actually provide cover, provide some aspect of screening, provide some element of, you know, thermal, like winter cover or even summer cover. So with that being said, we're doing kind of a smorgasbord. We're doing what we always strive to do, looking at the land from a water management perspective, from a solar management perspective, and then ultimately that equates to vegetative management. So how do we break this up? How do we create some isolation in certain areas, but also how do we get deer to move from, you know, point A to point B, so on and so forth. And again, trying to bring in, from a holistic standpoint, trying to bring in all of the actual factors that come into play. Because my biggest pet peeve is like creating ideal plans that can't be executed. Right. And, you know, something as simple as like, okay, you've got this 30 acre chunk that's all planted in pines. Well, that's pretty easy. Let's just go cut down all these pines here and put a food plot there. Sweet. Yeah, you can do that. And then you're either going to doze them all out or farm around a stump every 8 feet for the next 25 years. Right. So again, like there's costs that are associated with that. And then, you know, so you're going to grow out these stumps. What kind of ground disturbance is that going to cause? What are you going to do with the stumps after that's done? Right. You know, so there's all those things that come into play. But yeah, I mean, that's the goal, is to really look at, we're going to utilize what can function as a screen, wherever we can function as a screen. You know, I'm even planning on leaving a couple pockets that don't have any needles at low points for some structure and really for some hot weather thermal bedding, you know, a north facing slope, southern breeze in the summertime, but a you know, what they do well at is keeping things cool in there, nice soft bed. So not big areas, but a couple little pockets, and we can wrap that with better vegetation. And in time, when that other vegetation fills in, we thin out or kill off those other ones, you know, thinking 25 years out in different stages of succession.
So I'm going to pull on a thread a little bit. There's two pieces of this. It kind of like echoes in my mind. One, and I say projects every year for my own self, and it's just, it's wanting to do things on my property and stuff, not leaving it stagnant. Right. And I've left stumps to burn. I burn out stumps. I've done that for years where I leave the stump, I let it rot down a little bit. Then I just, like in the wintertime, go over there with my kiln and I'll just put a kiln around it and I'll burn it, right? Burn it to the ground. Best time to do it in the wintertime. But when you have a multitude of stumps and you decide you don't want soil disturbance because maybe it's fragile soil, or, you know, you don't want to bring heavy equipment in there. And these, you know, feller bunchers, basically as they cut, they can cut low, but they're not going to cut like ground level.
Yeah, about 3 inches.
Like, cut them ground level. You can cut them as close as you can, or you can get back in there and cut them and then throw dirt over them. I've done all different things. In this case, for like maneuverability purposes, like what you're thinking right now with that issue?
Well, I'm a big fan of, you know, again, thinking from an efficiency standpoint, I'm a big fan of like a dirty plot, so to speak, right? Like, yeah. You know, if we get real big plots, it's a little bit different story, but this property, you know, and it's all relative, right? So like if it was like a, what I refer to as like a main event type food source, or that real like destination type anchor food source on a property that ensures that those deer are coming and going at some point in a 24 to 48 hour period. If it was something like that, then, you know, then it probably would make sense to get in there and doze it up. It's a bigger project, but it's probably worth it. This property, however, has enough diversity. We're doing some field conversion. There was some old fields that were, you know, on bad access. So they kind of just got left fallow when the property changed ownership the prior time or somewhere around there. It's, you know, there's a lot of, this property is like multiple properties, multiple sections or tracts of land that have been purchased from other owners and kind of joined together. So this property owner bought this property that was a combination of many properties over the last 5-10 years. So it's kind of a lot of different access points that they're all connected. So it's a really unique big block of land, and it's a beautiful, beautiful property. And the landowners are great. They've been great to work with and everything. It's just, again, there's just kind of these unforeseen challenges where when you look at it at face value, you're like, oh, we can do these things. But then when you start to really dive into it, there's a lot of expenses. And the stump thing, you know, I have that conversation with clients. You know, there's, from a dirty plot perspective, you know, I'm not opposed to it. And frequently we'll just bring a mulcher in and mulch the stumps off at grade or slightly below grade. I bought a Vale tree saw for my skid steer that I kind of bought for that purpose. Like you can turn it vertically and kind of grind stumps. It takes a little bit longer than a mulcher, but you can go real deep if you want. But ultimately with that, I think just running it horizontally, I think what I'll do with that more often now is bring it in and just try and shave those stumps off flush with the ground. Most of these guys, you know, if they're planting with a, you know, a no-till system where they're just kind of broadcasting in, knocking it down, maybe they're crimping, maybe from time to time they're lightly disking or something, or no-till drill. I mean, a no-till drill will roll over those no problem, right? So, and that's really the big thing. If they're in a situation where they're tilling frequently, then the stumps become a problem. But also I think it's a good thing.
Or sub running a subsoil.
Or a subsoil. Well, and actually what I've found is, you know, if it's not a big white oak or something, or a really big cedar, you know, cedar stumps don't break down real fast, but the roots themselves die back pretty fast, to where a lot of times after like year two or year three, you can run a subsoiler through there and it'll pop. And actually it'll pop a lot of those little stumps right out, which is kind of
nice. Yeah, I've seen that too. I've seen, it depends on the species. So if it's softwood, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that's it. That's a pretty good option. Yep.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately I think most of these situations, our goal is to get that stump as close to the ground as possible and just farm over it and let it break down slowly. I mean, it's not a bad thing to have. I mean, it's a big carbon source in the center of your food plot, right? It's just,
you know what? I'll tell you, I talked to Jim Ward a couple of years ago and he kept telling me, you know, hey, we're leaving stumps in. And I said, you know, I've been leaving stumps in for years. He's like, I don't want to create more disturbance than necessary, particularly in the areas where you have fragile soils. I want to flip topics on you.
Sure.
All right. I want to be controversial, not to anybody else but us. So you text me last night. We're talking, and you said, "I listen to your pod podcast." And I had a client call me this morning to talk about my pod podcast. And I had a couple clients text me and ask me questions because there's water holes in their designs. And they're like, "What do I do?" And I said, "Whoa, pause." I said it's situational dependent. I'm talking about my property in most of these situations. I need large volumes of water for the projects that I'm trying to create because I'm extracting water to irrigate food plots. Like I have a whole different purpose. I want big water sources. In my case, on my property, I want warmer water sources because most of my water sources are natural springs. They're super cool. They're 55 degrees.
So you want to slow that down and warm it up a little bit.
Warm it down. So one of my objectives was to have water in an area where it wasn't going to evaporate at a high rate. So it's on a north-facing slope. I'm taking water from a downward stream. It heats up as it goes through a pump. It actually heats up. The tubing heats it up. It goes up, and it actually heats up what's in that basin, and then it spills off. That is an example where I'm creating, you know, 20 to 25,000. It's about 25,000 gallon pool. You could swim in it. It's kind of like a swimming pool. That's what it looks like, with the intention to benefit hydrology in that area, but also the food plot. That is a example. So one singular example in context. I made a statement in there that I'm getting away from water holes. I'm going to let you comment on this, but I'm just going to make this simple statement. I don't have time to spend effort doing work in these in-ground systems that can't be flipped over, pulled out. I don't want to scrub them. Like if I have stagnant water and the only source, the resource is rainwater or related runoff, I don't necessarily want the work that comes with that sometimes. I mean, rainwater is usually relatively clean, and that's a good resource. We should be collecting rainwater and using that kind of as our pond staple. Like it's almost like it's non-deterred water. And I'm a fan of water holes. I just want them big.
Yeah.
Big. Yeah. And I want good water sources. So clean water sources, big water holes. I want you to talk about this topic because you shot me a message.
Yeah. I totally understand where you're coming from. I think, you know, again, every situation is completely different. Every individual person, every individual property, year by year, you know, priorities change, time commitments change, stuff like that. I don't disagree with the things you're saying, except for the, I don't have time or don't want to invest time in the waterhole side of things. The way I would look at that specifically is, you know, what is that thing? What is that time? The thing that moves the needle on a property? And some properties, a small waterhole isn't going to move the needle at all. But in a lot of them, it can potentially, right? In some properties, it can be the exact opposite, where that small water hole becomes an intrusion risk because now you're in there all the time filling it up and putting pressure on that spot in a spot where otherwise those deer don't really need that resource, but you're there providing it for them and it's counterintuitive because you're just there more and you're pressuring them out, right? So I want to back up on that for a second and then I'll go down my tangent on the water hole side of things. But you say on time commitment. So we've talked on and off. We haven't went into full detail and maybe you did a podcast on it, but I knew what you're doing. I could envision it, but essentially this pond system you built a ram pump to move that water uphill, right? What is the time commitment / maintenance required to maintain that ram pump?
This is a great question because it has been a fine tuning process. So I had to build in some filtration into it. I've got to have a pretty good system to limit a silt into the drive pipe. So there's kind of a combination of protecting the inlet, protecting and collecting silt, creating enough downward pressure water. It's kind of involved. And I get irregular stops with that ram pump. So last night we checked on, it's full, right? The pond is full and the ram pump stopped. I was working the day before, we just had a rainstorm. Every time we have a rainstorm, we get an influx of water, and I can't control the sediment and debris in these streams. I don't want to. The natural process is we should allow that to be, you know, pushed downstream if it's not going to stay upstream. And so, you know, you put these little head dams in and stop things and stuff like that. So long and short is every 2-3 weeks, I got to check on that ram pump, minimal. Right. And is the ramp up in a location where I'm going to create the least amount of disturbance on the property? Yes. It's in a really good location away from a bedding area to do that. So can I get remote benefit from that because it's got this long line traveling some distance away? 100%. So the design is intelligent, but there's work with that. And to your point, There's work with any mechanical system that you have on the landscape. And I do see the negative to that, but I also could decide, well, I'm just going to let rainwater fill it up anyhow. Right. I could, because it's already filled at this point. Right.
And that's exactly what I was trying to get you to say, right. Is like, there's two sides of that. I can go out. And again, if you have the vision for the utility of the pond, then it makes absolute perfect sense. I mean, the reason why when we started talking ram pump, I knew everything that you were talking about is because I went down that rabbit hole and I've got half the components. I was planning on building a pump system, but my pump system would have been purely for capturing rainwater. So it would have to be primed and prepped and ready every time there's a rainstorm. But basically what I wanted to do is capture the rainwater off of my house and move it up to a reservoir on top of the hill that I could then use to irrigate my garden that's on the hill above my house. Right.
Yeah, I like that.
So yeah. that was the whole point of that. But from a deer hunting perspective, like all the things you just mentioned there, you know, if you're building this pond system, this wildlife watering hole for improving holding power, improving attraction to maybe increase huntability on your property. So my goals for how I preach to people, holdability, huntability, management efficiency, right? I say those three goals over and over and over again when I'm talking to clients. You know, we come across the scenario, here's a project, here's a possibility, and you probably get this too. You know, like these guys have a vision in their brain. I love to work with that. I love to build off of it. I love to learn from them. But we walk a property and they're like, you know, I was thinking this in this spot. And I say, holdability, huntability, management efficiency. Does it check those boxes? Does this do anything to help hold deer on the property? Does this improve your access, improve the huntability as far as like you're drawing deer into an area that's more accessible and it improves opportunity for you? And then what is the level of management efficiency there? Because I don't want to see you spend your entire summer figuring out how to plant a food plot when you could be doing X number of other things with that time that move the needle a lot more. And I don't want to see you spend your entire summer going in and out of this bedding area or adjacent to this bedding area to fill a water hole or fuck around with a ram pump to make sure that there's water up on top of there. Right. So that's my point. You check those boxes and you go, you know, again, if there's utility to it, it makes a lot of sense. And maybe, you know, and in your situation too, if you have how many gallons was that pond? 2,500, 25,000. So it's not like if that pump stops working, you have to get up there and fix it immediately. Right. And how many days it probably took a few days to fill it, but it's not like it's going to empty overnight. So, you know, in that sense, like if the pump's not functioning come October 1st, you're not up in there on October 2nd, ensuring that, where if your water hole is empty on October 1st, you might as well go in there on October 2nd because October 15th is going to be a lot more critical, or October 30th. You know what I'm saying? So
there's trade-offs. There's
correct.
Major 100%, trade-offs to 100%. Small versus large water sources. So let's get back to, let's talk about the maintenance of a water hole in your perspective.
Yes. So that's where I was going with this, you know, so like if you don't, like if the big pond, which obviously has a lot more added expenses and planning, right? Like you shouldn't just go out and, please don't just go out and buy a pond liner and be like, I got a buddy with a mini excavator. He's coming over. We're putting this in, because your pond will fail. Guaranteed your pond will fail within 5 to 10 years. You'll have a leak in it. Then you're digging the whole thing up. And it's even worse. You got all the mud and the sludge, the muck. You got to peel out the liner. You got to throw that. You know, if you're going to do it right the first time. Strive to do it right the first time. And I'm not going to claim to be an expert on putting in ponds, because I don't do a lot of big ponds by any means. I've got guys for that. So, but ultimately, when it comes to the smaller ponds, like if the small pond makes sense, where, you know, again, the things I preach to the client is, when it comes to pinch points, there's really one type of pinch point that we aim for, but there's two different types of pinch points, and that one type is a hybrid of the two. So we're looking to create one of these types of pinch points. The first would be a physical resistance type pinch point, right? Something that's choking deer down on the landscape. Maybe it's how they use cover to navigate, or, you know, actual physical barriers that choke them down. The second type would be an attraction based pinch point, something that draws deer in. Could be a food plot. You know, it's all relative to the attractiveness, right? So it could be a food plot. It could be a single apple tree. It could be a watering hole. It could be a mock scrape. You know, a mock scrape and even a watering hole in most situations, I'm not going to rank that on a scale of relative attractiveness to the extent that it's going to, or we assume that it's going to draw deer in from 500 yards away, maybe even not even 150 yards away. But if they're moving in this general corridor and we drop this point of interest in there via a water hole or again, a mock scrape, then we can influence that last little bit of movement. So we're not trying to force them to choke them down through a really tight pinch. Instead, we influence their movement into there and then draw them in the rest of the way with that type of attraction. So if that is what the fit, form, and function is, as far as water hole goes on your property, then I love these earth ponds where you can take them out, drop them in, get them flush with grade. And if there's even a slight slope at all, you dig just a subtle channel on a kind of a V on the uphill side, and all the water 10 feet on either side of that, that, you know, once the ground reaches saturation, that excess water comes down and it channels into that pond. Now with that, yes, from time to time you get silt. With that, yes, from time to time you get leaves. I mean, the leaves are obviously falling in there. Sticks are falling in there. What you don't get in there is dead squirrels. Or the other day I had a guy text me that he pulled 3 dead turkey poults out of his Rubbermaid tub. You know, exactly. So like those are nasty. And I had a client a couple of years ago that had a fawn get stuck in one, and it was just, they're ugly. And literally they're ugly. I've done it before. I've done kiddie pools. I did an old bathtub one time. They're ugly. I don't like to look at trash in the woods, right? I want a more of a natural setting. But on the maintenance side of things, generally what I do with the earth ponds is, and this is true with most of my summertime activities, if I'm going into those more sensitive areas, doing camera work, whatever, I'm trying to do it ahead of a rain. Because mentally in my brain, I'm like, if I'm in there and I make some changes and then we get a good flush, my sense out of there, you know, things recover a lot faster. So at the same time, I just take a rake with me, a garden rake, a steel garden rake. And sometimes I'll take a broom, like a, you know, just a stiff bristled floor broom. You just two, three swipes, you drag out all the debris in the bottom. And then again, you can take that broom and you kind of swish it around and just get most of the water out. And then when it rains, it fills right back up and it's good to go. And then the other thing that I do with those, actually, I should probably be careful. There might be some legal sides to this. So where legal, I put a couple scoops of mineral, this is a trace mineral in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
To increase the salt content in the water, which drops the freezing point a little bit. So, and I do that, you know, like late in the summertime, you know, even like a lot of times what I'll end up doing is I'll have like a little bit in my pack if I go hunt that area a couple weeks before it's going to freeze or a week before it's going to freeze. So I ensure that that's in there. And what that'll do is it'll drop that freezing point. So when you get those first frosty days of the fall and every puddle on the landscape is froze over, that pond stays open. And those
do you think in my liner pool, my swimming pool, do you think I should have a salt water hole?
Like off to the side? No. Like the hot springs or something?
Thanks everybody. Listen to part one. On part two, Thomas Mills and I get back into some of the details on waterhole placement. We get into some of the decisions around increasing huntability of interest in deer around water resources. We kind of go in a few rabbit holes. We talk about how we don't bait anymore on most of the properties, the client properties that we have. And I explain exactly why I'm recommending not baiting deer, in particular supplemental feeding deer in addition to baiting deer, and why that's a bad practice. And lastly, we get into some of the ins and outs of, you know, trying to look at our landscapes more holistically, having kind of this ideal approach. And again, the benefits of some of these tactics or philosophies that we have should likely support you in your habitat design. We'll see you next week.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.